Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The Supreme Court had two rulings today, ruling that death row inmates can challenge execution by lethal injection right up to the last minute, and also ruling that a Tennessee inmate on death row can use new DNA testing on 20-year-old evidence to try to clear himself. Both rulings lay the groundwork for future legal challenges, and we're going to find out more about them from Jonathan Turley, professor at the Georgetown University Law School. Jonathan, can you help us out here? This is confusing. Let's go to the second ruling, the one at the Tennessee inmate. We feel we've seen many death row inmates cleared by DNA evidence, and now the court is saying that Paul Gregory House of Florida, who's accused of killing a neighbor, can use DNA evidence testing to try to clear himself. Why is this ruling important?
Well, it's important because the Supreme Court adopted a standard, an innocence-based standard, in terms of these types of belated appeals. That is, you can make these types of challenges, certainly, in your direct appeal and then what comes later, something called a habeas appeal. But at some point, it becomes much, much harder to do that. Certainly here, 20 years later, he falls under an innocence standard. That the Supreme Court says that if you really want to raise something new, you have to have what's called reliable evidence of innocence to be able to essentially open this matter up again. And what you saw here was a split on the court, that Justice Kennedy said that this is good enough, even though Justice Kennedy said that this by no means constitutes what he called conclusive exoneration, because what was involved here was simply a finding that the semen that was tested belonged to the husband and not to this man. That doesn't mean that he was necessarily innocent.
And it doesn't mean that the husband is guilty.
That's right. But Kennedy said this is significant enough that you should have an opportunity to raise it. Chief Justice John Roberts and Scalia and Thomas all disagreed. Justice Samuel Alito couldn't participate because this was argued before he joined the high court. And so you had the most conservative wing of the court saying, we don't think this is good enough. I expect that if Alito did vote, there would have been four votes. So this would have been a one-vote margin case, because I can't imagine Alito would disagree with John Roberts on this issue.
Well, what does this mean for other cases? Can you broaden it out for us?
I think it means a lot, because it really does loosen up the standard a bit. Obviously, people like Chief Justice Roberts want a very narrow standard where you have to show pretty convincing evidence that you are indeed innocent, not something that raises concerns or questions.
And those are the cases that we've seen before where evidence absolutely cleared someone.
Yeah, and I think that what they're talking about is that this DNA evidence has to have just clearly been, to give an example, the only evidence used against the individual, something that is just knocking it out of the park in terms of an evidentiary issue. The majority in the court said that's really not the standard we want. We want to allow for people to bring these actions when they raise these types of significant questions, even though they're not conclusive. Mm. That, I think, is going to be a very, very significant ruling.
As everyone rushes to look again at old evidence. Well, the lethal injection case, the other case decided today, the decision put down by the Supreme Court, involved Florida death row inmate Clarence Hill. In January, he was strapped to a gurney with IV lines in his arms, ready to be put to death, when the Supreme Court intervened and stopped the execution. And now they've issued this unanimous ruling allowing last-minute challenges. Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, it couldn't have been more dramatic. I mean, this is really something out of a Hollywood picture. You know, you got a guy who's literally seconds from being dispatched, and the phone rings. And here what the court is saying is that these people do have a right to raise an Eighth Amendment challenge that the types of chemicals used would be cruel and unusual in terms of the pain they inflict.
And we should say that Hill had run out of appeal, so he went to court using a civil rights law, claiming that his constitutional rights would be violated by the drug protocol.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is that during oral argument, some of the justices noted that state laws would not allow this combination of drugs to be used on animals that is veterinarians would have a problem, a legal problem, using these chemicals to put out an animal. And that, I think, had a big impact, frankly, on some of these justices. Not that they necessarily agree with it, but what they're saying is that this falls within the legitimate question of the Eighth Amendment.
So Jonathan, help us here, because every state that has capital punishment uses it, lethal injection, with the exception of Nebraska, which uses the electric chair, and that's being challenged. And other inmates have challenged lethal injection, claiming it's unnecessary suffering. So what does this ruling mean?
Well, I have to tell you, I think that this is going to end up in a series of skirmishes on the trial level as states come up with a standard mix of chemicals. It's amazing, quite frankly, that we don't have that today, that there isn't a uniform view of what the chemicals should be or how they should be administered. I think, frankly, this opinion is going to have a very good impact in the sense that it's going to force states to get together and create a uniform approach using a better scientific work. Minimizes any pain, and it's probably going to be a uniform national standard. Of course, the biggest problem is it's hard to really gauge what the pain is. You're obviously putting someone to death. It's not going to be a pleasant walk in the park. At some point, their heart's going to stop. And there's another complication for the states, and that is they're worried that if they give someone too much of a deadening agent, that they won't be able to tell, indeed, if something does go wrong. So there's a delicate balance here. So the states, I think, are going to have to go back to the drawing board, get together, and come up with the best possible scientific standard they can do. I think if they do that, most judges are going to sign off on it, and as long as they can see that effort.
Well, Jonathan Turley, in the few brief seconds we have left, while we have you, a string of major rulings is expected from the court this month, but they didn't rule on the legality of Guantanamo Bay military tribunals today. Any predictions how that ruling might break down in the court, especially following this weekend's news about the suicides of three detainees?
Well, you know, that is, of course, what everyone is talking about. The expectation is that Sam Alito's addition to the court was a huge advantage for the administration. They had a very close ruling just a few years ago against the president. Sam Alito is viewed as someone who is truly radically deferential to the administration, and I think so is John Roberts. I think he has shown in the opinions he's already issued that the president put Chief Justice on that is so deferential, it's quite remarkable to executive power. So I think that the administration is really hoping for a win now that they've changed the court. One of the cases I'm looking closely at is a case called Clark versus Arizona. This is a fascinating case about the use of the insanity defense. You know, three states don't even allow you to bring an insanity defense. And this is going to force the court to decide whether there's a constitutional right to be able to raise insanity. And once again, Sam Alito's position on the court gives an edge to the administration, but it'll be an enormously important decision.
Well, and there are many Mondays left in June, and the decision will be coming in. Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University Law School. I think I moved you over to Georgetown a few minutes ago, but Jonathan, thank you as always.
It's a great pleasure. See you.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai plans to arm local tribesmen to help defend against an increase in Taliban attacks. In the last 3 weeks, Afghanistan has seen the biggest increase in violence in the last 3 years, with over 500 people killed. Will the president's plan to arm warlords announced yesterday help or lead to more violence? That's just one question we're going to put now to Christian Science Monitor foreign correspondent Scott Baldoff. On 9/11, Scott reported from Afghanistan, the hub of Osama bin Laden's operations. Later, he was embedded with American troops as they fought the Taliban. Scott's also been covering the rebuilding in the tsunami-ravaged Indonesia and the Asian economy. Based in New Delhi, India, he's about to switch posts to Johannesburg, South Africa, and he joins us in the studio for a reporter's notebook before he goes. Scott, welcome, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
And first to the recent news, President Karzai says he doesn't want to form militias that could clash with rival tribes. He just wants to strengthen the districts to safeguard them from, you know, the Taliban. But what's your sense? I mean, is it inevitable that arming the tribesmen will lead to militias?
Well, Afghanistan is never going to be a functioning society in the way that America does, where you have the rule of law and people people will obey and pay attention to their policemen because, you know, number one, you don't have the money to create enough policemen to guard all of that territory. There always need to be tribes that help to keep the peace. And this is the way traditional societies like Afghanistan did keep the peace in the past. Tribal elders would sort things out. Several tribes would meet. They'd sort out their differences. And maybe they would fight them out with gunfire. With Karzai bringing more power to the tribes, this is an effort to try and give them a leg up against clergy and to support the state. But mind you, there are major problems. Many of the people who are going to be rearming are the same people who have been disarmed.
Well, in fact, I want to ask you about that because you were embedded with American troops when they fought the Taliban back in 2001. I'm remembering a report where, in fact, we listened to it this morning, where you said there's an amnesty to provide safe passage for some of the Taliban soldiers to withdraw, to hand over their weapons to the tribal elders. Did they?
In many cases, they did. Taliban were, after all, in some ways a glorified tribal organization themselves. They were mainly Pashtun, ethnic Pashtuns, which is a much more strong tribal society. Many of them looked to their neighbors and said, look, please don't come after me. You can have my guns. Please don't take away my land. Please leave my wife alone. I'm just going to withdraw now. And so during that time period, there were territory that shifted from one side to the other without firing a shot. Now, of course, they did keep some. And, of course, some of them have actually, the Taliban have gotten some more of their own since that time.
Why the increased fighting now?
Well, I think this is a test of the new NATO presence that is taking over command, particularly in the south. Whenever there's a transition like this, even if it's from one U.S. unit to the next, then the coming year is the time to figure out, is there a hole in their defense? Can we exploit things? And this is what the Taliban are doing. Now, with NATO, it's a bigger concern because, you've got the British are in charge of Helmand province, which is a major drug-growing area, and there's a lot of clashes that are related to drugs. Up in Oruzgan, you've got the Dutch, and the Dutch very recently were having a big public debate. Do we really want to send our troops to Afghanistan? Or is this just going to be a repeat of what happened in Bosnia, where our troops are basically powerless yet have huge moral obligations to protect the population. So it's a sticky place for NATO to be going into, and the Taliban are looking at this as an opportunity to really test.
We're talking to Christian Science Monitor correspondent, foreign correspondent Scott Baldoff, who's about to make a big shift from India, where he's been based, to Africa. In the few seconds we have, we're going to take a break, come back with you. One of the reasons President Bush gave for going into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden and set up a democracy. Osama bin Laden, in just the few seconds we have, we'll come back to this. You're shaking your head no. Any sense of it being closer to reaching him?
Well, there's always intelligence chatter about where he is. The problem is it's a bit like Elvis. You really aren't sure whether the chatter has been based on something. People like to talk, and there's certainly possibilities in the area, but
whether or not he's already left.
Yeah.
The building.
Yeah, he's
so
left
to speak.
The building, exactly.
Scott Baldoff, we're going to come back and find out more about your reporting. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
It just happened very close to us, actually. We heard mortars landing at around 2 o'clock on a nearby police station. There are reports of 7 killed inside and several wounded as well. These are supporters, many of them, who have come from outside of Najaf to harass American troops from behind, and particularly the police force.
That's a section of a report from Christian Science Monitor foreign correspondent Scott Baldoff, reporting from Najaf, Iraq, in August of 2004. We're back with Scott, a little reporter's notebook, as he moves from India to South Africa, 5 years of covering South Asia. And, you know, in that report, Scott, we talked to you that day. It was a day when mortars were flying all around you. Coalition and Iraqi forces were fighting with Shiite militant Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army in the city of Najaf. And you didn't make mention on the air of something that you did off the air. You and a group of other journalists crossed the battle lines to try and rescue two reporters who were inside the holy shrine there where the militants had set up headquarters. First of all, what did you see? Tell us a little bit about it, that experience, that behind-the-scenes experience.
Well, the group included the people who were inside the shrine were Thorne Anderson and Phil Robertson, and they had been there for a good number of days documenting what was it like inside that shrine, what was life like on the other side of the line. It was very risky for them to get in. They had to go through alleys and to avoid snipers mm-hmm. on both sides of the line, both U.S. troops and from the Mahdi army. And they called. We were in touch with them by satellite phone. The photographer I was working with, Cale Alford, is married to Thorne. So, she was in touch. They felt that they were fine as long as they were in the shrine, but they wanted to get out. They wanted to file their stories. Mm-hmm. How to get them out? They didn't feel safe really coming out.
No, so, I mean, the battle lines, mortars flying, and you had, you say, about an hour to get in and get them.
We then talked to the U.S. troops. And to the commanders and said, look, this is what we want to do. We want to go in and basically call both sides and arrange some sort of ceasefire to get out people who want to get out. And we'd go in as a group and come out as a group. And the Mahdi army would have less of an incentive to kill. And if there are a group of journalists, they were very media savvy people, actually, the Mahdi army. And we felt that we would have more safety in numbers. So, yes, we only had about an hour. We told both sides we'd be in and out in an hour. And that just, but in the meantime, running around and talking to as many people on the inside, fighters, doctors who are treating wounded. Dying people, absolutely. And getting as much of that in, as we can and then get out. Mm. Honestly, if I didn't mention it on air, it was mostly because there were so many other people who were involved right. in that process.
But what a tough thing, because you couldn't take everyone out you wanted to take out. I'm imagining children, and you knew that maybe they would not make it out.
Well, there were people who came up to, there was a doctor who begged us to take an injured man out. Yeah. And, he clearly had been a fighter. And honestly, once you get into that position of, yes, it's humanitarian to take somebody out of a battle zone, but there were ambulances, and those ambulances themselves should be protected and allowed to cross the line. The ambulance drivers wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. We just discussed it amongst ourselves, and there was just nothing we could do. And honestly, looking at the gentleman, there was not much time left mm-hmm. for him. Mm-hmm. So you have really, really difficult decisions to make.
Well, now you go from these war zones. We talked about covering Afghanistan, covering Iraq, albeit for less time, to Johannesburg, South Africa. What do you think the issues are there? What do you expect to be the big story there?
Well, that's what I'm getting my head around right now, frankly. I'm doing a lot of research about what are the big conflicts, what are the big issues, what are the big signs of hope. This is something that the Monitor always looks for, is that counter story, because so much about Africa tends to be written with a very, very dark outlook. This is a continent that rarely gets it right and hasn't really had many positive stories coming out. So you look for both the Darfur type cases that are big name. You go to a place like Chad. Unfortunately, nowadays you might have to go to Somalia, mm-hmm. which is in a very, very fluid phase of going over to the other side. And you're also going to be, I would be going to find businesses and towns that are starting to work. Where people are making changes for themselves.
And looking for social issues, I'm assuming the AIDS crisis in South
absolutely.
Africa. And speaking of which, a social issue that you've reported on while living in India, we just want to touch on with you. We've reported on it briefly, but it's selective abortion.
Yes.
This is a couple's aborting female fetuses, and the phenomenon grown really larger because of sonograms and the fact that they now know the gender of a child. Just in the brief time we have, how big an issue is that there, and how is India grappling with it?
Well, government officials feel like they have grappled with it because there's a law that says it's illegal.
Except that.
There are these mobile vans that'll go around from village to village. And it's very clear that they are advertising for this purpose. We can help save you money down the line, because there's an economic downside to having a girl. You'd have to pay for her wedding someday. Mm. You're going to have to pay for her dowry. And so, the law is flouted so much so that in some provinces you have, 750 maybe girl children to 1,000 boys. And, that's going to have a huge, huge impact down the road. So technology has provided many Indians in traditional, particularly in the North, societies that favor men and look down on having girls. It's very common, actually, for people to ask me, do you have any children? I say, yes, I have two girls. And they have this frown on their face. Oh, I'm sorry. And it's heartbreaking because, I love my girls. But what do you do? How do you correct that?
Scott Baldoff, a story that he's leaving behind in India as he leaves India and goes to Africa. And what he finds there, you'll hear about in the Christian Science Monitor and here on Here and Now. We thank you for all of your reports over the last 5 years covering South Asia and look forward to what's next. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
Head of the United Automobile Workers is telling his union members things have to change if the American auto industry is to survive. The UAW is considering its future at a convention in Las Vegas beginning today. And UAW President Ron Gettelfinger acknowledged in a report released yesterday that the union's health care costs are a factor in the American automobile industry's decline. He added that the union needs new and far-sighted solutions to deal with the challenges ahead. Well, joining us from Las Vegas is Micheline Maynard. She covers the auto industry for the New York Times. Welcome back, Mickey. And boy, this feels like very different language from the union.
I've covered UAW conventions over the years, and generally the president's report is kind of a cheerleading document. It's our accomplishments, where we want to go. It's always very upbeat, but I was struck by the language in the report that Ron Gettelfinger is giving to the members. It's very blunt and very realistic.
Right. As you quote someone in the paper today as saying, it's instead of preparing them for a fight ahead, it's sort of preparing them, and I'm paraphrasing, to sort of lose.
I'm not sure if the UAW would agree with the word lose, but I think at this point you have a crisis going on in Detroit. You have thousands of workers being offered buyouts, and it would be very hard to pretend that things are business as usual.
Well, we've spoken before about your belief that health care costs for union workers in the auto industry have contributed to ballooning costs. But he did not, we should hasten to say, he didn't let, the auto industry management off the hook.
No, in fact, he's very, very blunt in his criticism of bad management. He says there have been missed opportunities, there's been too much money squandered on ill-conceived international ventures. In other words, things like GM buying pieces of Fiat and Suzuki and Isuzu, and basically bland designs. And it's kind of the same criticism that outsiders have leveled at Detroit. It's very interesting to hear it from a union leader.
Right. You also write, Detroit automakers' share of the industry fell to its second lowest level in history just last month. You've written a book about these problems. It's called The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. How much do you think Gettelfinger's, new acknowledgement to his union members that they may have to take some cuts in health care coverage, how much is that expected to help?
This isn't new news to anybody who follows the auto industry, but it's sort of a new point of view or a new way of thinking about it. Even over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of resistance to change. In fact, the health care cuts that were agreed to at General Motors and Ford were only approved by 51% of Ford workers, and that really rattled the UAW. I think people were expecting a little bit wider margin of approval.
But by the way, we should say that was just earlier this year, right, where workers agreed to take responsibility for more of their health care costs. But that also points to, they have been making concessions.
They have been making concessions in certain ways, and it's not wage cuts so much, but it's being flexible on things. I would point to the health care deal. One of the big things that's being discussed right now are buyout offers from General Motors for workers at GM and workers at Delphi. And it's essentially the union saying, okay, the company will pay you to go away. Make up your mind. The UAW hasn't lobbied their workers for and against the buyouts, but just by allowing GM to offer them, they're getting out of the way if GM wants to eliminate jobs. And so, that's a sea change for this union.
What are some of the other changes that might be on the horizon and the union president might be warning will be on the horizon?
The big, big battle will be at Delphi. Delphi is the big parts supplier that General Motors owned until 1999, and they went bankrupt last October. In court, Delphi is asking a judge for permission to cut wages first from $28 to about $22 an hour, then to $16 an hour if GM will step forward with a subsidy. If GM doesn't come up with the money, then it wants to cut wages to $12.50 an hour, which is from $28 to $12.50 is a pretty significant drop. The UAW had resisted making any concessions to Delphi at all, and that was why they asked the judge to give them the permission to impose the cuts. Now, over the next couple of months, there'll be negotiations, and we'll see if the UAW finally bends.
What else might be in the future?
Well, over the next year, we'll have major negotiations at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. And, you know, one thing I think they have to think very seriously about is the shape of the contract itself. The contract is the size of the Manhattan phone book. Mm. I mean, those are pages and pages of work rules and job classifications and things that limit the flexibility of what workers can do inside of factories. And those are all issues that will come up for discussion over the next year.
Well, as you write, membership in the American Auto Worker Union is dropping to its lowest point since 1942. And here we have the president of the union warning that there are going to be some changes on the horizon, that the union members have to come up with solutions. All of this is coming as the UAW is holding its convention in Las Vegas. Can you give us a sense? What's the mood there?
Well, it's a little early to tell about the mood, but I don't think this can be one of those, you know, party central kind of conventions where everybody's here to meet and greet and have a good time. I mean, I was joking to my editor this morning, it's kind of like law school where they tell you to look at the person next to you and the person on the other side of you because one of you won't be here at graduation time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, for some of these union people, this will be the last convention for some folks that may be taking the buyouts and deciding to give up their jobs. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a gloomy mood to come into Las Vegas.
What is the relevancy of the UAW right now?
Well, you know, the UAW has been very historically important, but there are people who are looking at the UAW as something from a bygone era. If you look at the new factories that have been built in the United States by the Japanese companies, the German companies, and by Hyundai from Korea, they don't have unions, and the UAW has not been able, for the most part, to organize those plants. And so, you know, workers all across the country who are auto making cars have said, I don't need the UAW. And what the UAW has to prove now is that it has a reason for being.
And what would be one demonstration of that? I'm thinking, you know, that workers don't lose health coverage entirely.
The airline industry has been a pretty terrible example of what can happen to workers when companies get in trouble. And for some of those workers, I mean, their retirees don't have health care coverage at all. They're forced to just rely on private coverage and Medicare. And so I don't think we're ever going to see that for the UAW, but we could still see a ratcheting back of the benefits they have. And another important benefit that, you know, may be in trouble is something called the Jobs Bank. And what happens to UAW members when they're laid off is they go into a special program that essentially pays them while they're laid off, and they are supposed to do things like retraining or community service, that kind of thing. But there are a few people that don't do anything. They just collect a check. And this has been enormously expensive for the car companies. And I think that will be one of the benefits that they try to eliminate in the coming year.
Micheline Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times, and she's covering the UAW convention today in Las Vegas. Mickey, thanks for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And still to come, did you read that recent New York Times list of 25 years of best fiction books and think, hey, where's my favorite? Well, you're not alone. As you'll hear, you're listening to Here and Now. Are you tired of partisanship in politics? Well, some veteran Washington movers and shakers are hoping you'll say yes to that question and then go online to vote for the next president and vice president of the United States. The effort is called Unity 08. The goal is to nominate a centrist third-party ticket online, only mixed tickets allowed. John McCain and Hillary Clinton? Would you have to do rock, paper, scissors to see which one would head the ticket? Joining us on the line from Maine is former Maine Governor Angus King, an independent who's one of the people leading the Unity 08 effort. Welcome, Governor.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. How would this work? I mean, let's just say that all of your online participants go on and vote securely, we understand, and John McCain and Hillary Clinton emerge as the mixed ticket that people want. How does it work?
I think the first step would be that they'd have to agree to put themselves forward under our banner. In other words, I suppose there could be a draft of some kind, but we're still in the process of developing the rules because this is the first time anything like this has been done. But the idea would be that you'd have to start with two candidates or a group of candidates that want to do this through Unity 08. And then what we would have, what we plan to have in the spring of 2008 is essentially an online convention. Any registered voter could vote. You wouldn't have to disenroll in your party or anything like that. You could be from any part of the country and pick the ticket. And it would be a ticket. In other words, you would not be voting just for a presidential candidate, but for a president and a vice president. And they'd have to be of two different parties. The whole idea really is to, A, give the American people a third choice in the elections because of the tendency of the parties to be polarized and produce candidates from their own base, and this is we're aiming more toward the middle. And secondly, ironically, to democratize the candidate selection process because if you think about it now, a relatively small number of voters in a relatively few states essentially are making the choices that the rest of us are locked into in November.
Well, some big-name political operatives are in on this with you. Hamilton Jordan, who was President Carter's chief of staff and who also helped direct Ross Perot's independent presidential bid in 1992. But as we all know, Perot was defeated. And as you all know, third-party candidates are rare in the history of American politics. One critic who's interviewed about the idea of Unity 08 said he calls you the unicorn party, sheer fantasy, because right now there's no candidate, no money, and no strong positions, let's say, on Iraq.
That's I don't know if it's a fair criticism, but I understand it because we're trying to do something that's very difficult, which is to rally people around a concept and a process. And typically a third party kind of effort usually is around a person. Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, Ross Perot in 1992, and we're not. This isn't being set up. We're not a stalking horse for some particular candidate, and we truly don't have a candidate in mind. Here's what I think is going to happen. I think we're going to perk along with, several hundred thousand, maybe a million members. I'd be ecstatic if we got that many over the next year or so. But as the party process starts to heat up and real candidates emerge and people start to see, okay, here are going to be my choices, the interest in what we're doing is going to go up like the famous hockey stick graph. That's what I predict is going to happen.
Who's paying for it?
Well, right now we're running pretty much on volunteer effort, and we are raising money, no PACs and no corporate contributions, but in the long run, we hope to fund it off of smaller contributions from the people who sign up on the web.
And you said you don't have any candidates right now. Really, do you have a wish list? I mean, what are some of the names that float around?
Well, it's really interesting. Since we've gone online, there are all kinds of names that are being thrown out. Mark Warner and Olympia Snow, John McCain, Chuck Hagel.
Olympia Snow from Maine, Warner from Virginia.
Right, exactly. And it could be somebody from entirely outside the political system. By the way, the last bipartisan ticket, interestingly, was put together by the greatest political genius in the history of this country, and that was Abraham Lincoln in 1864 when he chose a Democrat, Andrew Johnson, as his vice presidential running mate, in large measure to try to unify the country. And really, that's the same kind of thing we're talking about.
Angus King, an independent and former governor of Maine, who's helping spearhead an online presidential campaign. It's called Unity 08. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. What's your favorite fiction book since 1980? Well, depending on your answer, you either loved or hated the New York Times Book Review list of the best books of the last quarter century. Earlier this year, the review editor asked a few hundred prestigious writers, critics, editors, and lovers of literature to identify the single best work of American fiction of the last 25 years. That one question raised others, including, what's American? What's fiction in a time of fabricating memoirists? Well, still, they managed to vote in Toni Morrison's Beloved as the number one best, and almost everything by Philip Roth made the top 25. Dwight Garner is senior editor of the New York Times Book Review. He joins us now from the Argo Network studios in New York to talk about some of the books that made the list, a few that didn't, and what people found objectionable about it all. Dwight, welcome.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you.
So, Beloved, the memories, nightmares of a plantation slave family living in post-Civil War Ohio. It's number one. Were you guys surprised when that's what came back?
You know, we were. In retrospect, maybe we shouldn't have been. But you know, when you look at that book, you start to realize that critical consensus has been building around it for a while now. I mean, it's really taught in colleges and you know, probably hasn't hurt that Oprah's behind it as well.
What did you think might have been number one?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's the kind of one of the reasons we wanted to do this is that it's sort of a great just conversation to have. And it's the kind of conversation we'd have around the office. And we really couldn't come up with a consensus. And that was part of the reason we wanted to ask, as we did 124 sort of, you know, well-known, really great writers and critics to answer this question for us. You know, I sort of thought that Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections might have a chance, and as it turned out, it I think got one vote. You know, I certainly thought Updike might have a chance, and you sort of knew Roth would be there, but I don't think anyone expected seven of his books in the course of the last 25 years to make this list.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, Roth has just been on a terrific late career run. I mean, his work for the last 25 years has just been mind-bogglingly good. And, you know, you remember this period maybe a decade or two ago when sort of Updike and Roth seemed to be sort of neck and neck. And Roth sort of put on the gas and seemed to have pulled away from Updike as much as many of us still, you know, love Updike's novels.
Some of us felt vindicated to see on your list Marilynne Robinson's 1980 Housekeeping.
God, it's such a beautiful book.
Isn't it? The story of a woman in Idaho. You know, Housekeeping, is that one of those books? Is she one of those writers who is a writer's writer, you know, more of a cult favorite than, let's say, a number one bestseller?
One of the things that sort of came out in the books that did well in List were that they seem to have a sort of reaching after a broader cultural scope and context. These books carried a certain freight, a lot of cultural baggage. And Robinson, as brilliant as she is, and I think deserved to be higher on this list myself, but her books are a little bit smaller, more precise, more controlled. And a lot of those kind of writers didn't do so well on a list like this. You didn't see Lori Moore. You didn't see Ann Beatty.
There are other criticisms of the list, as you well know. People talking about it. And also critic A.O. Scott's article that accompanied the list. People said, you know, not enough women or people of color, you know, other than Toni Morrison, of course, who was number one, not enough women or people of color represented in the judges.
Yeah, well, in terms of who won, we hear a lot of criticism that the list tends to be white and male for the most part. And our only response to that, I guess, can be is that, you know, we didn't pick these people. We asked, you know, our jury list ran from people like Nadine Gordimer and William Styron and DeLillo on the one hand to younger writers like, you know, Jonathan Lethem and Curtis Sittenfeld on the other. And these were the responses we got. We did ask, I think it turned out that 31% of the responding judges were women. And we asked quite a few more than that. The percentage wasn't quite 50-50, but it was higher than that. And women didn't respond in the same numbers that men did, which interests us. Maybe they're not as interested in the whole idea of literature as a horse race, which, of course, we're not really either. This is more just a you know, great way to get the discussion going.
We'll have the list, by the way, on our website, here-now.org. But I'm noticing Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, the, you know, iconic Vietnam War era book.
Oh, and it's a lovely book. We were so pleased to see that because, in a way, even though it is about the Vietnam War, O'Brien is such a terrific, precise writer. And it sort of went against the prevailing trend of these sort of, you know, as I said earlier, these books that you know, sort of went after a more sweeping cultural statement.
Was there any discussion of whether A Confederacy of Dunces, one of my favorites, it's by the late John Kennedy Toole, should have made the list at all, since it was actually written in the 60s but published in 1980.
There was a lot of conversation. I remember actually being in the office the day the first vote came in, and we ultimately decided this was how we had to do it. We had to, you know, allow any work of fiction published after 1980, you know, in its first hardcover or softcover form to be eligible for this list, just to be true to the ethos of the whole thing.
Right, and to remind listeners, the way Confederacy of Dunces was published is he had actually written it earlier, and then John Kennedy Toole tragically committed suicide, and his mother brought this manuscript to Walker Percy, novelist Walker Percy, after his son's suicide, and then it was published after 1980. Who else jumps out as someone that, you know, was a surprise to you? I'm thinking maybe Norman Rush?
Norman Rush, Mating. I think a lot of us predicted that. I mean, it's such an enormously powerful novel, Mating. I think some of us were surprised, and maybe incorrectly, that Cormac McCarthy did as well as he did. His novel Blood Meridian, very, very dark novel about bounty hunters, you know, almost was in league with Beloved. It came in just in second place. Even though he does very well, I think he's probably less known than writers like Updike, DeLillo, and Roth.
It's interesting to go back and see how some of these books were received when they were first published. Kirkus Reviews has done a list of your list of the top books in the last 25 years with some of their initial reviews. And of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian in 1985, they wrote, "There's something stubbornly impressive about McCarthy's unwavering gloom, but its stentorian, pretentious prose will quickly dissuade most readers from attempting to share McCarthy's dark vision."
Well, those, of course, are exactly the kind of reviews William Faulkner used to get when he was, you know, writing his first novels. And I think McCarthy will ultimately be talked about in the same kind of tones we talk about William Faulkner.
Who didn't make the list that you would have liked to have seen?
Oh, boy, that I would have liked to have mm-hmm. seen myself. I mean, a personal favorite is Nicholson Baker. His small, sort of microscopic, brilliantly observed novels like The Mezzanine and Room Temperature, I just think are lovely and will be read for a very long time. But I think his work may somehow not be broad enough. I think voters, as I said before, sort of leapt for these books that carried more cultural baggage. And I think Baker just doesn't rise over that bar, even though for me, those novels are close to perfection. One thing I got to say that surprised us quite a lot is that we didn't see books on this list from the younger generation of writers like Jonathan Lethem and Rick Moody and, as we said before, Jonathan Franzen, William Vollman, David Foster Wallace. Maybe it's too early to judge these novelists, but we were surprised some of them weren't there.
Did I read somewhere that there was a thought, and maybe you said this, that it was possibly that maybe these younger writers, most of them living, you know, didn't want to vote for each other?
I think there may be some truth to that. They may not have wanted to give the other guy a vote. But, you know, as I said before, we thought the corrections might stand a chance at really taking this thing or being close to taking this thing. And it may just be a case that for Jonathan Franzen's novel, which is brilliant, and also the work of people like Jonathan Lethem and Rick Moody, it may just be too early for people to really have a sense of how well their stuff's going to hold up.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll have your list that the assembled critics and editors and writers voted on, and we'll also have your list of the ones you think should have made it at our website. We'll put it all there. Dwight Garner, senior editor of the New York Times Book Review, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
For the sequel, Dwight will be back tomorrow with a list of his personal picks for beach blanket books. Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the